Farms. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioners and Councillors. Firstly, I'd just like to start off, give a wee bit of background. You've read all our stuff, but in summary, our property in 1965 basically had run 200 sheep, one tree, and supported no families. Today, it's 1,600 hectares, 18,000 stock units of sheep, cattle, and deer. You can read what we've put there. It's in our support of the plantings that we've done and the amount that we do on an annual basis. We've worked closely with Environment Southland, including Fish and Game, to maintain the willows on the rivers. On our side, we have the Braxton on one side, and we have the Hamilton Burn on the other side of our property. We've right at the headwaters of the Aparima, with two properties above us to the mountains. And we've been able to improve river flow and fish habitat with working with Environment South and Fish and Game without any legislation. We've recently had a sustainability officer for a whole day on our property, and he had some fairly positive comments to make for us, and with a limited number of suggestions, and we're still waiting to hear back. We've been involved with the liaison group for some time, and work with them. So that's part of our property. Just quickly, some forestry and shelter that we've done on our property, and as I said, for a start, it had supported basically nothing. Some wildlife areas that we've taken out in the galley. We've planted trees up, various types of trees, and we've got ponds in there for settlement and for wildlife and everything. It's been fairly successful, planted years ago by my father. Just moving on, we have had some data and some testing. It might be a little bit hard to read, but you've got it there in front of you. We've tested the upper and the lower. The high one down here is due to Canadian geese. They have since been removed. The answer there is quite simple, that seagulls and Canadian geese have more E. coli an issue in their crap than they have in anything else that we can think of. So if you look at those test results, we actually have no impact to water quality. We're actually improving water quality, and that's with sound management and without legislation. And if you look at all those results there, basically all are within, well within your guidelines, and they are all improving as they go through our property. So your question is how have we done this? This is above our property. It's a fenced off riparian strip. The river runs through here. It is now covered in broom and gorse, which is now polluting our property, and we're having to tidy that up at a significant cost. It's a haven for pests, as I've mentioned to you, about Canadian geese, not in, certainly in this area, but if you get flat areas like this, that's where they'll congregate. And as farmers, we've been successful at trying to move them on, but they are quite difficult. And as I mentioned, no fish life. So this is on the same river in our property. You can see there there's a temporary where we've had the fence, where they've been fenced off at critical times, maintained free of weeds. The river course has been in the same place for many years, and as I said, water has improved. And to answer your question, Morris, to one of the groups before, there is much less erosion. In this photo here, the banks all up the river are all just solid gravel, and they're just eroding straight into the gravel when the broom and gorse are going into it. In this case here, it's been here for years. We've got grass right down the edge, and a big river event, it goes over the top of it, doesn't erode out the banks or anything, and it just stays in the water course, goes back down and continues on. So hopefully that'll answer your question there, Morris. And it's done with improved species. You've got good grass species on the side, and it's well maintained with sheep. Some key area concerns with the plan, physiographical zones. It's been well documented. You'll see on the maps of our property, there's 250 hectares of peat wetland that they've actually classified in the zones, where in fact it's only 10 hectares. So that actually requires us to have a consent based on your definitions for intensive winter grazing on this class. The issue I have is that when you go to the next phase of this plan, which is limit setting, that the limit setting is based on your physiographical zones, and if they are incorrect, how can your limit setting be right? And based on the Taupo experience, which some of you will be will have known, it became a disaster. So the first thing is you must get the physiographical zones right, and as farmers, we know that better than anybody, rather than somebody down in an office down here, so we need to work together to get that right. There is known areas of peat wetland that's not classified. They have no restrictions to land use or anything, and so that's a major for the, it's a huge benefit for them, a huge detractor for people that aren't. So I believe that farmers need to be able to challenge this so we can get it 100% right. The intensive winter grazing has been well documented, about the 50 hectares, and I'm not going to go on too much about it. It'll take us 28 years to cultivate our property when pastures are only basically for 10 years. Individual farmers should have the right through their farm management plan or Appendix N to cultivate the appropriate areas without consent. I don't think we need consents. I mean, some of us farmers are doing the right job. It should be through guidelines and just through approving your FMP and just getting on with it. And the cultivation details about this FMP being required by the 1st of June, I think is ridiculous with the date of the 1st of June, because it doesn't allow for any climatic events caused to pasture during the winter to be corrected. Second one, cultivation on sloping ground. The definition of the water course, we've gone through that. I've written out the one from Fonterra, but I believe Fonterra is 12 months, not 6, so it's a correction of us, and I definitely believe it needs to have a gravel base. Spraying, classified as cultivation. It's not classified as cultivation, because spraying of weeds are this broom and gorse in the area that I've talked of, if you need to, for control measures prevents that. Suitable buffer zones, I've mentioned to that in the photos previous to that, and I just think they should be temporary so that we can do the management that we've done to prove that the water quality increases and the bed stays in it, and maintaining the healthy species. Gravel, there are limited areas on some of the rivers that are causing sediment damage, and as you know that this area around here, there is just huge sediment loss, and the soil actually causes more erosion than anything. That used to go through there, where the river used to, and I believe that we've got an existing gravel consent. We should be able to, with notification to the councils, just get rid of this area or somehow get that river back to where it was to prevent all this. And there is a bit of an issue. We've got one member of our group who's similar situation. I'm lucky I've got a gravel consent at this stage. He's been waiting 9 months, $6,000 later, and he still hasn't got a gravel consent. Whereas this needs to be done now. It doesn't need to be wait 9 months, because in 9 months' time, that river will be right under here, and there'll be a massive build-up. So there's a bit of an issue there about being fairly quickly to do some of that, get it done. Land holding, page 111 in your book. I'm against all being joint certificates or under one instrument, because clearly it's a negative towards larger owners. It takes no account of different farming locations on different physiographical zones, different management systems on joint certificates or titles, different farming systems on land to improve water quality. And this rule was connected to Rule 23, and that's where I believe it's flawed. So I think the land holding under one entity should not be a limitation, especially under Rule 23. So it shouldn't matter about whose land holding is or not. It's got nothing to do with it. I mean, good practice with larger landowners, the smaller landowners that are a lot worse than what we are. So basically you're making a rule that large landholders are more at fault than the smaller ones. And economic impact, I have seen in the last 24 hours that there has been an economic impact report done for this report, but I think it needs to be in a lot more detail. It's very vague for what I've seen. I haven't been able to read 360 pages last night. I didn't want to be like Paul and spend up to midnight. But I think it has serious consequences, this plan, if it's implemented in its current form for a lot of Southland. And we've actually shown a positive impact with that legislation, both in an economic return from the land, parents of the land, weed and pierce, family supporters. And this has all been done while improving land, you know, water quality without legislation. I believe that the council needs to identify and correct the offending parties and leaving the majority of farmers who are improving water quality to continue the good work without intrusive costs. And to answer your question, Eric, which you mentioned before to the group, you have the capacity to go and do it. I just believe the council needs to go and identify those people and actually go and visit them, because we know of some that you haven't visited and you should have, and you seem to be targeting the easy fish rather than the harder ones, and you just need to get a little bit harder. You have the tools, you just need to go and do it. And by the implementation of your farm management plan, that's the way you can do it. Because if you've got a farm management plan and it's been approved over time, that's how you can have access onto it. And the other key is communication. You've got to communicate, as the council needs to communicate, a lot better to farmers, because the stick doesn't work. The being proactive and communicating and working with farmers does. So thank you very much. Take questions.
Yeah, see if we do have any questions. Wood?
More a comment than anything. I've been on your property with John, and I was very impressed with the photo you showed there of the ponds and the way it was set up. Two ponds with a bypass channel. I think that's something that we should be using going forward. So I was actually very impressed with what I saw.
It does have issues. We have one of those ponds that is filled up, which I've commented on, and through that needs to be addressed. But yeah.
Thank you. You made it clear to me.
Yes, good afternoon. Just on your landholding commentary, you've got the rule 111.
Yeah, as I said, that was I put rule, should be page 111. So I said just in the thing, it's page 111. Pleased you've picked that up.
Yeah. So can you just describe what you're talking about there? Large landholdings may be held in different titles, and separated.
So at current, you have a landholding rule that if you've got one group of the same people, they all their landholdings, regardless where it is all classified as one. So they're all classified as one. It takes no account of landholdings in different physiographical zones, for instance, up one end or in different zones. It takes no account of any management plans, which, if I can get that back, please, which I've said, no management plans on the properties, or work that we're doing in, I'll just quickly flip. Yeah, different management systems on joint certificates, so that you're working with, or different farming systems on land. For instance, you've got sheep and beef, and you've got deer, grazing or bull beef, whatever, suited to the land. So it has no effect, which is more effect than actually the land holding. So the intention of that, the way I interpret it, is that you don't want anybody to own any more land, basically over 50 hectares. So you're limiting the progress of farmers and bringing everybody back to the bottom.
Just one question, thank you, Peter, and thank you for your presentation. And I'm also familiar with your property and have some respect for the way in which you're operating. One of the things which you and other members of the group have promoted is addressing what might be inaccurate assessment of physiographic zones. In practice, how do you see that would work, given that there is a temptation for some people to who may be using inappropriate practices on physiographic zones to try and demonstrate that the classification isn't correct? So just in practice, if you could just sort of give us a steer practically how you might address
that.
Well, in
practice, I think it's quite easy, Eric. Get a spade and dig a wee hole and you'll see the difference between the different, because it's based on soil types. Well, based on our property, on those maps on our property, it's basically just about follows the soils, all the different soils on our property.
Okay.
So my understanding is the physiographical zones were done many, many years ago. I don't know, that's what I've been told by the council, that they were done by Environment South, and they were done many years ago. That's how they were set up, because I have challenged them and tried to find out how these physiographical zones have been come about and everything, and I have not got the same answer yet, or got a satisfactory answer. But I think if you go onto the property with the farmer, with your sustainability officer, and work through some of those, you know, the differences, it'll come quite clear. And if you go onto our property, you will see very clearly that the area marked there is clearly not peat wetland, whereas I can show you another areas which is very clearly peat wetland. So I think in a physical and a visual and common sense, Eric, we can work that out.
By collaboration, basically, is what you're saying.
Yeah, but I think farmers need to have the ability to challenge it, like in our situation, because potentially it has great ramifications, whereas having a rule from a desk is not satisfactory.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you about the gravel situation. I guess what you're saying is that you should be able to take that gravel out as a permitted activity without having to go through a resource consent, is that right?
No, what I said, Morris, was that if you've got an existing gravel consent, like we have, we know the rules of a gravel consent, and most farmers do that have them. We can go and either remove that gravel or make the appropriate decision of what's best to do with that gravel. And in fact, if we go to that shot, you know, it might be the best decision to put a channel up through here and stop it somewhere here, that in a big flood that it comes down and goes back into its course and this comes over, you know, the gravel stays on this side. Or whatever's the best way. I mean, we've worked with Jimmy Vent for Environment South and for a number of years over the gravel consent, and we come to a sensible solution of what's best to happen. But the issue is that some farmers are struggling to get a gravel consent, and once you've got it, we should be able to just go with notification, we've got an issue, come and visit it and deal with this immediately. Because the biggest issue with here, Morris, is this: every time there's a freshwater flood, it's tearing into this bank all the way around here and taking out more each time. So the speed of correction is the issue here, of getting that fixed straight away, because it's just creating more gravel in here each time and eroding more of the bank, and as you and I know, there's more sediment goes down.
Yeah, got that. Is that something that you could have as part of your farm environment plan, do you think? So that, you know, you have a certain set of conditions you could operate by, just like...
Oh, definitely. I think it'd be great if people like us on the river, it was part of the part of our appendix end, that we didn't have to get a consent, that if we had... that'd be fantastic, Morris, and we just didn't have to get a gravel consent. We could just come in and, you know, look at areas like that and deal with them appropriately without having a consent, because the consent process costs money, and as we've seen with one of our members here, he is still waiting. It's 9 months and $6,000 later, and he still hasn't got a consent, and he's got areas like this that are probably worse than mine, and it's causing a huge amount of damage. So, yeah. Do it without your farm management plan, no consent, and deal with it. And we can show from past, you'll have records of us, that we've proven that we can take gravel out in certain areas, and the banks are the spots are the same and approved.
Okay, a bit easier said than done, but something we can look at.
Well, maybe not easier said than done. We've done it. We've got evidence of done it for a number of years, Morris. So
in terms of getting the consent right and all that sort of thing.
How do you get the consent on?
I've been able to do it without a consent. I mean, I know what you're on about, but, you know, just getting the right sort of set of conditions to allow it to occur without having to get a specific consent for each site, there's merit in that. And you'll know that the council is working on that and on the major rivers as well.
Yeah. So I think that comes back to your communication, like I said before, is that, you know, the council knows who the, you know, the good people are and know the people that aren't. It comes down to a bit of experience. A number of us have got experience in there, so why should we be brought down to the lowest denominator that we don't know what we're doing, where we've proven for years that we can do it and have done it. And you guys, the council are coming and visiting. Jimmy Vent's been up. He hasn't been up recently for obvious reasons, but he normally comes in every year. I give him a ring and he comes and has a look around our sites and has a look at it. And we discuss it more than happy, and we've done that for a number of years.
Yeah.
And we've proven that we've actually improving the water quality through doing it. And the reason by that is that running across, you know, areas like this and without the soil going in.
Thank you.
Just one matter I wanted to ask you about, and it's an issue that's been raised by a number of speakers earlier this afternoon. And there seems to be a reluctance to have to gain a consent for activities such as winter grazing and cultivation.
Yep.
I'm curious about that. And on one hand, I can understand that, because no one likes to be told what to do or have to get a consent. But in other parts of the country where I've worked on similar issues, farmers who can gain a 10 or 15 year duration consent for these types of activities, which provides them security for that period of time, because a consent can't just be cancelled, unlike a rule and a plan which can be changed by a council at any time, they see that as an asset. Have you given any thought to that?
Yeah, I have, because I'm involved in a dairy farm that you'll be hearing later on in your term. It's at mid-catchment. We've got a consent there that it's for 15 years and work through the consent problem. The problem is that a lot of farmers are scared of the consent process because of the cost that has to be employed, the time that farmers have to do, the requirement to get it done, to get it started, you know, initially. And one thing that we've seen in the dairy industry is that they are sold as being easy. Farmers can do, you know, I remember, you know, 10, 15 years ago, a farmer could do a consent, do it himself for a dairy operation. There is no way a farmer can do it now. He needs all these expertise, people in to come and do it, consultants and everything. It's created a whole new industry of people who are making a huge amount of revenue out of that. And are they actually gaining, benefiting that hugely? Look, some are, some aren't. But a lot of the farmers that you're talking to regarding this environment, that's been their livelihood, their generations. I mean, we're a second generation. A number of the catchment is third, fourth generation, that's their livelihood. They don't want to destroy their livelihood because that's their future. And the problem we're scared of is that there's a number of people who are probably uneducated today because they haven't had the experience, are making rules from a table like what I'm sitting on, have not been out there in the practical world and actually physically viewed it. And that's the scary part, that there is a reluctant for consents because of that reason.
Understand that, and understand there might be concern about the initial costs of getting consent, but again, if that was a 10 or 15 year duration consent, when you discount that across that time period, it's not an unreasonable cost of it.
No, it's not unreasonable, but would we get the consent? I've just explained to you before, there's a member there that's still waiting 9 months to get a consent for a gravel, just as an example. Mm-hmm. It's cost them $6,000, he hasn't got it yet, he's still trying to get that consent through. I mean, this is the problem we're facing. I mean, I got as through some years ago, and we normally don't have an issue, but you only need one party of a consent to hold it up, and I'm not gonna mention names, and you guys will know seriously what the issue is there. It just keeps coming back for answers that there's a problem. That's the reason the consent's been done, because there's a problem. Time is normally of the essence. That's the issue, I think.
So just one follow-up question. In terms of that then, I mean, the council has the ability within the plan to specify that applications won't be notified. They won't be publicly notified. It has that ability. So what if that was written into the provisions?
Well, I'd like to see a bit more detail. I'm not too sure what you're talking about, a specific there. I'd like to see a specific what you're actually referencing to. I mean, I think it's got to be work between the farmer. It needs to be between the farmer and the council. The communication needs to be a lot smoother, because I believe at this stage we're still a fair way arms apart, and some parts of this plan has moved us a bit further apart than an arm. And I think we need to get a wee bit closer, and if we can work it through together in common sense, we don't need to go through all this legislation. But maybe if we have to have a legislation that we can get it for 10, 15 years on agreeable terms, that's fine, and the rules don't change.
Yeah, I understand that. Right, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Willowbank Farms.